Hola, que pasa? Welcome to the Coogan Chronicles podcast, a podcast where... Where what, AJ? What happens here?
Two former child actors, being you and myself, Chris.
Love to scream into microphones. And what do we do, dude?
I mean, everyone knows this already, but we talk to other former child actors. Maybe eventually we'll talk to... About growing up in the business.
In the business!
Maybe eventually we'll talk to other directors. We'll talk to casting agents. We'll talk to people that work at SAG-AFTRA. We're going to start to branch it out. Agents, but right now, we talk to
former
kid
actors. Strictly to who was in the spotlight. That's who we're sticking to at the moment. And you were just ranting about.
Yeah. I have something to talk to you about on this intro today. I'm going to set the stage and then you're going to share your opinion.
Okay.
So
here we go. Ready for this.
The idea is this, that when you are a former child actor, there are certain rules that are laid out for you, things that you can do and things that you can't do. You have to cut your hair a certain way. You have to go to a certain acting class. You have to take certain headshots. You can't leave town whenever you want to. You have to stay in LA and be available for every audition that may potentially come up, even if they're not right for you, even if it's just like so wrong, you'll never book it. You have to be available for it, or you risk them not sending you out for auditions anymore because you're the person that wasn't available for a week because you
questioning your commitment and loyalty to this whole thing.
Right. And then the other thing is you have to be comfortable with performing any role, no matter what the subject matter is, no matter if it goes against your religious preferences or any. It's like as a child, you should have no moral or religious preferences that could get in the way of you playing any role whatsoever. So you just accept whatever it is. I'm exaggerating to give you a platform to share your opinion. But the point of it is there are certain things that you're supposed to be okay with. And if you're not okay with it, then you run the risk of not being put out for future auditions because there are other young performers that are willing to be okay with whatever. What's your opinion on that? You think that's true or not true?
I think it is absolutely true. I wonder about this day and age in particular, whether that's changed because we've gone through this big growth period in the entertainment industry where things have those type of restrictions have definitely been cast aside in many respects for a very good reason. But that is the disclaimer to saying, I imagine it still exists in some capacity because at the end of the day, I think what you're getting at to me rings true in the most sense it rings true is to say when you sign up to be a former kid actor, whether you realize it or not, what you are actually signing up for, what the real job you are signing up to do, the real commitment is a lot of those things. The real commitment, especially, I mean, for us, it was I had to cut my hair a certain way. You know, like my haircuts didn't go by way of what I wanted to do or what my mom thought was cool. It was a process. They went to my mom, saw the way other kids were, how they, which ones were working. She asked my agent and manager. So look, are we going to cut off the big mullety back of Chris's hair and just let it shag on top? Or are we going to keep this big mane going? Are we just going to let it go? You know, these were decisions that were made collectively usually, and almost always an agent or representative or someone we were working with had a very strong opinion about it, you know? And so yes, whether you was it or not.
Yeah. Now, we've talked about the haircut thing before, but it impacts so many facets of the young performers.
The stranglehold on you can't go anywhere, you don't get vacations. You are here every second. That for sure rings also incredibly true. My parents had no idea that's what we were doing, or maybe they did, and they were just like, "All right,
this is great. We can get around going on vacation."
Yeah, that's literally it, you know? And so you know, especially when you come to LA, you end up at Universal Studios all the time. Like that's
you don't go on a vacation. It's like if you're working on location,
that's the vacation. Exactly. And everyone's just waiting around for that. You're just like your trip to Romania and New Zealand. That's it. That fulfills that, checks that box. For us, I got to go out to Vegas to do something once for a weekend. That was my one vacation in 5 years with my family. You know, it's like tagging along. So that's it. You know, there was a lot of work that still does happen in Vancouver, especially from the West Coast in Canada. And so almost everybody I knew was always going up to Vancouver, and that was the vacation. You go out there and you do the six or eight things that all the tourists do there, and that's it. That's your life. That's the vacation there. And so whether you realize it, that you are signing up for that. I got to imagine though, it's a different thing now. I think the climate of the world where you know, you know, backlash can be swift, fierce, and unforgiving. And so I imagine that if I'm an agent or casting director or producer, I got to imagine the way that I tell people what they can and cannot do is very lenient these days. So I don't know how much
that
they get away
great.
With that.
No, that's definitely a change for the better.
It. Yeah, I would hope so, you know, because that's, that is the sentiment offered and was offered to all of the kid performers. Like, now you're here now and jailed. You know, yeah. You're stuck here for life.
Yeah. But if you leave jail, you can never come back to jail.
You can never come back to jail. That's it. If you leave, you're out and you're out for good. It's a scary thing. Even to this day, every former kid actor I know, including myself, it is a lot of turmoil that I have gone through to be able to say, hey guys, I'm taking off for a second. You know, and it's always met with like, cool man, have a great trip. But for me, I'm like, hey, is it okay? I'm asking for permission. And that's not completely true. I've gotten past that, but for a long time it was. That was the way that I.
So Chris, who do we talk to today?
We got Kevin G. Schmidt. Kevin is an old pal of mine. He's a kid that I grew up with, that I saw in a lot of audition rooms. We didn't even know each other well, which has been so amazing about this process and reaching out to people. Is like, I didn't have Kevin's phone number. Kevin never had my phone. I don't think we hung out solo ever, you know, but we, just because of the way in which we worked and all the different places that we were always working in the same capacities, it's just like, once we were adults, we're kind of like, all right, we're bonded. There's a bit of family bonding that we accept, you know? And it's awesome. So when he saw that we were doing this and he was really supportive and really happy we were doing it, and I asked him to be a part, he jumped at it. And it's so awesome that we get to have him and his story on here, because it's really dope. And this guy's super smart and he worked a ton. You probably know him from Cheaper by the Dozen, The Butterfly Effect. What else do we got on there, AJ?
I mean, all those guest stars that he did on like
everything. Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Squeakquel, The American Wrestler, The Wizard with John Voight. He was in The Young and the Restless for a long time. He starred in Princess Protection Program with Selena Gomez and Demi Lovato. He received an Emmy for the ensemble cast in Steven Spielberg's sci-fi thriller Taken. So the guy's, he's been around the block. He's worked more than, I imagine most actors that everyone watches and thinks are very accomplished longtime actors. And he does it in a different fashion now than the way he did growing up. And it's really cool to hear about it and how his life evolved. So without further ado, this is Kevin Schmidt. All right, Mr. Kevin Schmidt, thanks for coming on the Coogan Chronicles today. How you doing, man?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for we just talked right before this. I know you, AJ and you didn't ever meet.
I just want to throw a couple of things out there. We've never met Kevin in person, but we both did episodes of Oliver Bean. We both did episodes of Numbers. We both did episodes of CSI. We both did episodes of I mean, we hit all the bases, you know, but we never.
So you guys share dressing rooms without realizing it.
No countless doubt. Times.
Yeah. No doubt.
Probably one wore each other's wardrobe fitting, one coming exactly. right out.
Yeah, totally.
There we go. They're probably the same set tutors, probably literally.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Sat in the same tutor rooms in the same seat, doing similar homework. It's interesting.
How do you and Kevin know each other, Chris?
Well, this is what I was going to bring, which is so fascinating. So Kevin has two brothers. Where do you fit in the pecking order?
In the middle.
You're the middle. Okay, so I'm the oldest. So Kevin's two brothers, all three of you were actors as well, right?
Yeah.
And so were me and my brothers. And so we knew the Schmidt family because if there was ever on the rare occasion that they needed like three brother actors, you know, if there was some commercial, like we need three brother actors, or there was a movie where they were like, we need to age the kid, you know, slowly. So if you got a brother, it looks just like you, it's great. Any type of these scenarios, which they were rare, but you know, over the course of a few years, there's quite a lot. We would always see the Schmidts, or we would hear about the Schmidts, and it was when you walk into a room and you suddenly feel like you're like in a parallel universe looking at yourself in the mirror, that always felt like that to me with with the Schmidts, because it was three boys, were all around the same age. We had our mom there, our dad there, and we're all chilling in a waiting room to audition together. And you didn't often see three boys signed up for acting together. It's a rare, I wonder what the, today I thought maybe we'll find out like what that kernel of truth is that's similar in our families that made that happen. You know, maybe there's something there that defined that route for each of us. That's exactly.
I was the reluctant one. So
were you? The middle one always is. That's always the, that's my brother too. He, he loved getting on the set. So he can get out of school. That was his big, he was like, once he got there, he was like, I got to work. that was his thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you, so to start us off, that's how we know each other.
The
origin story. What's the, in like four or five sentences or less, like how did your, how did the whole family come to be a showbiz fan?
Okay. Let's see, condense this. We're all from Wichita, Kansas. So it's Southeast Kansas. It's actually the largest city in Kansas. Wichita. My mom was born in Martinez outside San Francisco. So she knew about the entertainment industry in Hollywood, but had no direct connection. When we were super, super little, my oldest brother, Kenneth, was the performer. And even, you know, he's a lawyer these days, he's still very animated and kind of is always looking for an opportunity to play a character, especially around Halloween. He'll make his own like costumes and create his own voice. And he's just silly in that way. So he wanted to be in movies and television shows. And the way that he did it as a kid was we'd watch all of our favorite movies growing up. And Kenneth would go up on the mantle on the fireplace and recreate every scene from every movie he loved. And he was like, Mom, I want to do this. I want to be in there in the TV. At the time he's like 5 years old. My mom's like, well, we're in Kansas, honey. That's not gonna happen. So she was a little more creative and resourceful about trying to find ways to help him see if this is something of interest, really. He wound up doing like talent competitions and like a spring catalog for the local mall type thing, walking up and down
familiar.
The runway.
Very
exactly.
Those.
That wound up in a baby pageant, which he placed in out in Century City in California when he was really young. We met an agent there. It was Gold Marshak at the time.
Oh yeah.
Old school.
Oh God. That name sends shivers up my spine. I forgot about that name.
This is Gold Marshak days. They were East Coast, West Coast. They were mainly East Coast. So we started going out to New York City when we were in grade school for summer. And it was three boys and we were all blonde, white haired kids in Manhattan, stuck out like a sore thumb. So we did our print modeling work there. Gold Marshak led to West Coast representation. Why don't you come out to California for a summer instead of New York? We went out to California and we didn't leave.
And then they trapped you. And then they put you in child actor jail. Like, you're here. You're going to have a headshot every 3 months for the rest of your lives. That's
exactly.
It.
They're like, how many decades?
Yeah. I can remember those Gold Marshak offices. And I remember sitting, I think it was Bonnie Leike's desk. I was like sitting at her desk and she goes, you know, I discovered Leonardo DiCaprio. I'm probably 12 years old. And I just like almost shit my pants right there in her office. Like, that you did what?
Leo sat here?
It was very impressive.
That is very
impressive. So that was it, from Midwest to East Coast to West Coast. And I, like I said, I was the reluctant one. I moved out full time when I was 10. I fell asleep in a casting office at my brother's audition. It was for a little boy role in this VHS film called Mind Rage with Tippi Hedren. The kid needed to be like kind of like internalized, a little like kind of catatonic-y. So when I woke up from my nap in the casting office, they're like, hey, you're next. And I'm like, I'm not here for this. And they're like, well, you should just try it. You know, you should try. I went in and I booked it. And that was my
because
first.
Of the nap, because you were
my
half
nap.
Awake.
Yeah. And you know what?
Like, wow, this kid's super catatonic. He's really good at this.
I dedicated the rest of my life to a decision I made after a nap at 10.
after a nap at 10 for someone who's sort of like, you know, kid, you're coming in. I was like, I'm not. And they just forced you in and life changed.
I've been napping ever since. Let's be real. I love naps. I'm known for my naps. It was what I think caught me about it though is, so I booked this randomly, like total happenstance how it all happened, but the scene itself that hooked me, I had a revolver in this movie that I found in my mom's desk drawer, and she was mean to our next door neighbor, who was this little girl, like my girlfriend, and she was like a drunk and angry. And I go into her bedroom with this loaded gun and I shoot my mom in this scene.
And that's what hooked you, and you were like, yes, oh, man, well, I'm an actor
was,
for life.
It was,
what does that say about you?
Right? She had squibs, right? Fake blood, explosions, and she collapses on the bed. The director says, cut. And I'm 6, 7, 8 years old at the time. Like, what is going on? Cut. The mom gets up and she goes to the director. How was it? It looked good. Cool. She's like, I'm going to go get a bagel. I'll be back. And I'm just like,
okay. So this, yeah, this begs a question. This basic question, as you look at it, is there something, I mean, I feel like if I'm listening to this, I know nothing about kid actors. If I just know any kid or not, I'm thinking that is really fucked up. That's super traumatic to do to a 6 or 7 year old, to shoot, not just shoot a gun, but shoot a gun at somebody, and not just shoot at somebody, but shoot at your mother, and not just shoot them, but kill them dead. Yeah. Like, there's so many layers to
well, there's blood shooting out of them, form there's of squibs.
Yeah, there's squibs. And then you said that's the moment you got hooked. And now, is that because you were a kid who does this and you just, the thrill of it, that's all it was to you? There was nothing super traumatic about that experience? There was no emotional sort of?
No,
you weren't suddenly picturing shooting your mom at 12 or anything?
Never,
and being like,
never,
why
never.
Am I feeling that?
So being a Kansas kid, like, I grew up hunting, right? So I grew up, you know, hunting pheasant and quail and stuff like that with my dad. And like, guns weren't foreign to me, even at a young age. We were always taught to be very safe and careful. I went to hunter safety like at 4 or 5 years old.
So
I was
are Wichita Cowboys. You guys are all good. You're like, just put a gun in my hand. I'm 7. I don't care. I'll go do my history lesson in a moment.
It was more the, I think on, for what hooked me was, one, something that was so emotionally intense in the moment, but I knew wasn't real. But even in that moment, I was shaking and my adrenaline was going, and to be able to recreate moments to where you aren't really acting, it almost becomes real for you. It was a high. I mean, it really was. And even flash forward now, like, I'm not doing as much acting as I used to. It's what I miss the most, is being in the scene with somebody and so connected to where you forget that you're performing.
It sounds like the perfect setup, though, for full traumatization of a child. I'm shaking, my adrenaline, my mother's standing there in front of me, it all feels so real. I black out, I don't even know what's going on. I raise the gun, I shoot her, real blood spurts out. She collapses on the bed. There's a long moment of silence. The director yells, cut. And the actress is like, I'm going to get a bagel. And you're just left standing there being like, I guess I'll get a bagel too and go back.
Exactly. Exactly. Fell in love with craft service right then too.
Yeah, that's all it is. You're like,
that's why I was such a big boy. That's why I got to be such a big boy right there.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So you have, speaking of that, a cheap guy doesn't speak. You have. We looked really like you were one of those child actors. You never stopped working, it seems.
And yeah, I just looked at your resume going into this. I'm like, this is insane. The number.
Yeah, you just never stopped. Like I got to imagine for anyone, you know, I imagine most people would be familiar with at least a handful of things, if not tons of your work, but also probably have no idea then what that would mean to do that much work. Like I got to imagine you it's 90% work, 10% school and extracurricular life. If you having worked and auditioned that much, is that probably a good percentage balance, you think?
90% work, 10% school. I was so ready to get my proficiency at 16 years old, I couldn't wait, you know? Like, being on set since you were 9 years old, working with adults your whole life, and happening to go to kid jail for school 3 hours plus a day, was just so, I feel like the skills I was learning on set and the people and the conversations were so much more impactful to my life than any day inside of a school trailer on set.
You know, being around you now reminds me of the interactions, albeit fairly limited. I think we did have some parties, some birthdays. There was some outside of audition hangs and stuff. I don't remember us working together on a set in particular, but I do remember the same circle in Oakwood apartments, that kind of thing. But I do remember all the time, I always got these same impressions. You have almost the exact same vibe now that you did when you were young. You were very, poised. You're very intelligent. You were very engaged with around, but in a quiet way. Like, you know, you're a very thoughtful guy. And, but you also had like this, as I remember now, I remember like the big mop haircut you had. That was the style of the day. But like, there was an intense, like you were okay with all the adults. You seemed to be one of them. I remember always thinking like, you in particular, maybe it's you and your younger brother, but like all you guys seem very adept at that, at sitting around the lunch table with all the adults and being like, oh yeah, no, I've been to Boise. Boise's nice. Yeah, that's a cool place. And just like, and just shooting the shit a bit. And you, it's no surprise then that you say you enjoyed it, that facet of it was meant a lot to you.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the environment of a set and I mean, even how sets have changed over the years, like some of these old tentpole studio features, $40, $60 million, $100 million budget, you know, we're making stuff now with 4K iPhones, you know, like so much has changed in the industry. But the talented people in every aspect, in every department, whether it's a costume designer or cinematographer, or even as I got deeper into like post-production directing side, like meeting editors and sound designers, and like everyone's just play such an important part in telling a great story. That's what I loved the most, was the collaborative process of storytelling, for sure. And yeah, it's carried through my entire life.
I bet. I mean, that doesn't happen for everybody. Everybody doesn't sort of suddenly carve out the curiosity as to how this whole picture comes together. I mean, actors more often than not just sort of stay in their lane, you know, and just like, okay, I'm an audition, I memorize these things, I'm a very emotional person. But yeah, it makes sense to me that you gravitated towards that and had a mind for it, because you were, as what from what I remember, you were like that. Like, you know, as a kid, you felt like that. You felt, you know, I don't know. I saw all kinds of kids that were like fucking around and just were there barely hanging on to what was supposed to happen and were just playing, you know. I saw some other kids who were collapsing in themselves, scared as to what was going on, very disconnected. You know, I saw kids that were just there professionally. You seemed to be really part of the group and really ingrained, you know. Did that just happen naturally, or is it just because you were on so many sets doing so many things?
I almost knew before, motorcycle gang right now. I knew right away that I was most passionate about directing. So acting was always a pathway into directing. I think the best part about directing is you get to work with every single department and help encourage their best. I didn't get from actor to director though. When I was 16, I was out in Toronto filming Cheaper 2. And Bonnie Hunt's been a huge mentor in my life and probably one of the most interesting and accomplished artists. She was an RN before she was an artist, Second City in Chicago. She wrote, produced, and starred in her first sitcom like in the 90s, like one of the first women to do that. So she gave me my first writing book when I was 16. And what the writing book helped me see was structure. And prior to understanding the structure of a story, it was just a familiarity from reading great content and being fortunate to participate in so many great stories. But once I saw the structure of telling a story, a three-act structure and turning points and the beats you need to hit to keep an audience going from conversation to conversation, it opened up the my mind to really the importance of every facet of the beast when telling a story. So for me, it was always the highly collaborative nature of it. You need actors who are hyper focused in on that tunnel vision of their character and the nuance and surprising you as a writer or director with your performance. You need dedicated actors. You don't want a bunch of guys like me on a set always being like, hey, have you thought of that? You know, like it's terrible, right? Yeah. You really need.
Do you mind me asking, were you like that as a kid? Did you take it upon, was that just sort of your thought process, or did you actually enact that? Were you on sets being like, excuse me, Steve Martin, maybe you want to try the scene? Like, was there ever, did you really inject that collaborative spirit?
I tried to be really careful. You know, As you'd think in a business of performers where you're on camera and you need to be bold, that everyone would have pretty thick skin, but that's really not the case. And even on, some really big productions, right? Directors and producers, like, you say one thing that questions their vision or their authority, and that can make your life a living hell.
I can hear your very thoughtful approach to your everything you're doing on set in your career. And I'm wondering, were you and your parents making very specific decisions about your career as a young person, or did it all in that measured, thoughtful approach, or was it all just happening and you're just going from job to job to job and taking whatever would come up?
I definitely said no a few times for sure. My mom was out there full time with us, from age 9 to, we had a little farm in Kansas. She ended up going back in early 20s. My dad had a family business in Kansas with his father, so he couldn't just move out like we did. So he would come out for a month. He would come out every other month and stay 3 weeks, and then go back and forth and back and forth. And it's a miracle my parents are still together to this day, despite that. It's really been a crazy journey when I think about it from my parents' side, as I'm 33 now as an adult, being like, wow, that's incredible that they were able to manage a relationship, let alone while we were managing this business. And we were just falling forward. That's probably the best way of putting it. But, there were certainly points where you came across certain auditions or certain characters and you're like, do I want to spend, if I book this show, do I want to spend 7 years doing this, and if that is a miracle, for a show to go 7 years, but is that really what I wanted? Is this the type of character I want to play? I have some friends and mutual friends who were kind of, playing some progressive type characters 15 years ago on TV. And then, it's a smash hit and you're making out with guys every day on set. And you're like, wow, this has become my reality. And it's a challenge, right? You want to book a great role, but as you start moving through your career, you're like, wait, is this something that I personally want to do every day and not just be for work?
So meaning like, I'm going to harp on that exact example,
yeah,
probably, but still. But it's that where like you're looking at the, because I remember that. I remember when you're suddenly faced with this decision as an actor when you're young, where you're like, oh, okay, so if I get this call back or this producer call, or if I go to network test for this, we sign all these contracts, this is potentially signing up to play this role in this show for the next 7 years of my life, which at that age feels like for forever. I mean, that's just like, mm-hmm. It's going to be the rest mm-hmm. of your adulthood into your, rest of your childhood into your early adulthood. And if the character runs up against, something you're like, I don't know if I want to do that, then I imagine it, I remember it affects my motivation in particular, good or bad, like there were parts mm-hmm. where I was like, oh yeah, I definitely want to play this for the rest of my life, or others where I was like, I don't think so. I don't think mm-hmm. I have this in me. So, but for you, was there a part then where they were like, you're a gay character and you're like, okay, and you're a young guy and you're going, I don't know if I can do this for the next 7 years of my life. Walk us through that a little bit. Like, what is that? How does that go down? How do conversations with your parents or managers, like, how does that whole thing play itself out?
So at the time when I was in a position for something like that, I did a pilot for ABC. It was called Sea of Fire. It was, what's her name? Jenna. She was, she came up in the Shonda Rhimes writing camp. So it was this real soapy, edgy, primetime, 7 p.m. kind of inspired by the edginess of Desperate Housewives on steroids. And the character I was playing was like a high school baseball player whose girlfriend goes missing in the pilot. And it's kind of like a murder mystery show, but everybody's got skeletons in their closet. Well, my character was a star baseball player who also had an undercover opioid addiction. And I was hooking up with my girlfriend's brother in order to get his drugs for me. So I was like, wow, I could potentially be playing a drug addict who's hooking up with my girlfriend's brother for drugs for 7 years. Like, is that the type of role I want to play? And at certain points in your life, maybe you're like, yeah, that's awesome. That's great. At 21, 22, after 12, 14 years in the business, I was like, that's a lot.
But you did it. But you did do
the
it.
Pilot, said, yeah. Yeah. I did the pilot. Yeah, so didn't get picked up, so the decision was made for me.
Yeah, it's made for you anyway. But then I got to imagine, like, walk somebody who's never has no experience with making that kind of decision, especially that age. Like, you know, what do you weigh out to say yes or no to? Like, you know, what becomes your focus on that? Is it just that it's great writing, it's a network show, and it's money, and it's impossible security, and there's it seems like a multifaceted, really interesting character, so you're willing to just kind of jump in? Yeah, is that really, that's what it comes down to, right?
It was an opportunity to play an edgier character than I've really had an opportunity to do. I'll use my, it's like almost you should have a guest on your show, but Sean Pyfrom can talk to you a lot about, you know, being on a hit TV show and a character goes in so many different directions and then you're along for the ride for 7 years and 100 episodes.
Yeah.
They don't consult you on that. It's not like they're going to Sean, for example, or to you and saying, what do you think about this?
They're which just, they really should. You just got to say yes. Which, when you think about it, they really should, you know, because I remember the only show I was a series regular on when I was a kid was we only did like 13 episodes of, but by episode 4, I was like crying about how much I was masturbating, you know?
Yeah.
And when I did this, I remember showing up and we read the table read and I was sort of I just read it like that evening before. And I was petrified. I was like, I'd never even mentioned, like if I, like the barrier in my normal life between me and talking about masturbation was so thick, you know, it's like nobody in my house was like, holy shit, that the fact they were asking me to go out in front of this whole cast of adults. And as I'm getting emotional about my inability to stop masturbating, the room full of adults are hysterically laughing. They're like, ah, ha, ha, ha. And I was fucking mortified. I was like, that was it. And nobody, you don't know that. My audition for that is not that, you know?
Yeah.
There's no masturbation speak. Sorry, go ahead, AJ.
Well, it's so normalized. Nobody's saying like, okay, let's take a moment. Are you comfortable saying these words? You know, is there anything that you'd like to talk
through?
Or,
we're thinking about writing this type of storyline for your character. It's touchy. No. I wonder how things are these days, but yeah, definitely at that point.
It's different at 22, Kevin, when you're talking about the role that you did, but this happens at 14, happens at 12. There's no reason why it couldn't have been the case when you were much younger that you booked that role.
Exactly.
So I get a question over your whole career. Then my guess is, and just the way you hold yourself too, you saw everything, you know, you probably saw every facet of what a young performer could see in the entertainment industry and experienced a majority. So walk us through, give me a couple of like the best highlights for you. Like obviously Bonnie Hunts was really influential on you. What are some of the other really great influences? And then walk us through some of the other really big challenges you felt. Let's do some of the highlights first.
Influences. I did the pilot episode of a miniseries called Taken. Spielberg produced it. And I got to work with Toby Hooper, director of Chainsaw Massacre, the original, Anton Yelchin, you know, RIP. That was a really special project. I was in Vancouver at the time. That's when the plane smashed in the World Trade Center too. So I was in the Georgia Suites. My mom woke me up and was like, hey, there's a plane that crashed into the World Trade Center. I'm like, Mom, it's a movie. You should probably turn it off. And she's like, no. So Taken really stuck with me for a multitude of reasons. Butterfly Effect was like being a part of it was like sitting at the grown-up table when you were way too young and they were so happy to have you there. That was incredible. It was a director writer duo, friends. Ashton Kutcher put up some of his own money for it to finance the film. It was like way outside of his scope at the time. That felt like being away at the coolest summer camp ever. The cheaper films, you know, are as much a part of my childhood as so many different people who still come up and talk about the movie to this day to me. That's really special. And then this,
because that's followed you. Correct me if I'm wrong. I feel like a year ago I saw on your Instagram or something, you guys had like recreated all the actors came together, recreate like one of the big iconic scenes from it. You know, and it seemed like everybody jumped on board. There was no loose ends. There was nobody that was like,
almost, guys. Almost.
Oh, almost, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. Yeah, almost,
who was the holdout?
Tom Welling was the holdout, Mr. Tom. We couldn't get Steve and one of the girls, Liliana. But other than that, we had everybody.
You had everybody. Yes.
But that was crazy. That video was nuts. It took my like YouTube channel from 50,000 subscribers to 500,000. Like it went bananas.
Over it that really one did. Video?
Over just, that one video. Like it has 180 million views on it. It's nuts.
That's so crazy.
And that's just on YouTube. It's on TikTok. Allison released it, did another 150 million. It was nuts. It was.
Do people, now outside of just the internet world or something, is that always followed you around? Like, do you still go get a cup of coffee and they're like, oh my God, are you the guy from, like, is that still follow you everywhere? Or what is that like for you?
Not so much just because I physically have changed so much, but yeah. Because of where I'm at in the community I'm in, like a lot of people are like, hey, Kevin, you know, by the way, what's going on the TV station, you know?
Yeah.
It's because it's just been a fun way to, you know, take that story and add to it. Those are the highlights.
Did you ever meet this one?
I did a one. It was Cartoon Network's first live action series. It was Unnatural History. Mike Werb wrote it. He wrote The Mask and Face Off and some really incredible stuff.
Two classics.
Right. And so I was doing parkour and Shaolin Kung Fu and stunts every week. It was the hardest I've ever worked in my entire life. 6 months in Toronto, 13 episodes straight, no break. Dieting the whole time. It was hard, you know, but wow. I saw.
How old are you?
I was 22.
Wow.
22, learned what I was capable of on that one for sure. And fortunately, even, you know, with all the different projects, I only really had one project that wasn't that fun. And it's because the director was such a douche. And this is like a big guy. I don't even care now to say it's Don Belisario from the JAG stuff. He's the creator of all shows, and he was just really rude. And he sat in his chair and barked orders the whole time. And I remember being on that set being like, this is not the type of leadership I would ever want on set, let alone in as a father, as a business owner. I was like, he got his son to play one of the other characters in this cold opening. It's literally the pilot for JAG NCIS. And he's like barking at his son the whole time. And his son didn't want to be there. And I earned the role, right? I booked it and auditioned, earned it, got there. And I'm like, this is sad, you know? So there was one project in all of them that I was just like, man, I don't want to work with this guy ever again.
You know? I got to say, it's amazing.
Like your career is, well, go ahead, Chris.
No, shoot.
Just your career is filled with so many successes. It seems just like a string of success and going from one job to the next. Were there ever lulls in there that got difficult, not knowing where your next job was going to come from, or like, did I make the right choice, or did any of that stuff spring up?
Yeah. There was a very odd, psychologically, it was a bit difficult too. There was an odd transition when I was about 17, 18 years old. I was like a late bloomer, and I also just didn't know what I was putting in my body and how to get it out. I was a chubby kid in all the movies growing up, right? But when I was 17, I was like, I'm ready to get my health in order. I'm ready to not be exhausted when I go up a flight of stairs. And when I was 17, I lost like 50 pounds of fat. Wow. And then I finally hit like a late growth spurt and I grew like 4 inches. And all of a sudden, the roles I used to go for, the, you know, chubby best friend, the comedic relief, now I'm getting thrust into auditions for leading men. And it was such an odd shift in perspective for me too, because it wasn't just in my professional life, it was in my, you know, my personal life. Like, I was the best friend of all the cute girls we grew up with and all the young actresses. And meanwhile, I'm just like, man, I really like you, you know? But I wasn't in a position to be able to like to execute on anything. Cut to, I take better care of myself. I grow up a little bit, I shed some weight, and now I'm getting the attention that I was seeking as a younger kid, even romantically. So the transition in the industry, which was difficult, is all these casting directors that I spent the last decade auditioning with knew me as the chubby boy. Hmm. And now my agents 1 year later is like, hey, you need to bring him in for this leading man role. They're like, this is Kevin. We know Kevin. Look, I'm sure he's doing better. Cool. And it took a year. I didn't work for a year after I lost all that weight until I had to reestablish myself for kind of leading man roles. And in knock on wood and counting all my blessings the entire time, because this business is ruthless. That was really difficult to go from working and this being not only your your a part of your identity, but your income, and then not working because you did something good for your health.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really messy. You know, it's interesting because my middle brother, Eric, mm-hmm. also, he like that was his niche as he was the chubby kid. And mm-hmm. he'd walk in and he had this big mop haircut. And he was like the chubby kid. And that's everything he ever did was like I think his claim to fame was being in The Adventures of Joe Dirt, this comedy mm-hmm. movie. Mm-hmm. And he's just a kid in class. Every time they cut to him, he's like, ho, ho, ho. And he's like eating Oreos. That's it. That's like his whole job.
They love to make the fat kid eat.
Love to make him eat, love to just love watch it. Him sit there and eat and stuff and giggle yeah. or look scared. You know, it's yeah. like, that's all I did. And, you know, it really, I always felt like just being a couple years older than him, I always saw it took a big toll on him. It took him, especially personally, you know, so he was going to school after having spent all his time where people are like giving him weird validation for being goofy and chubby. And, you know, and it was a big reason I think he receded from it, that he really unplugged and didn't like it. He didn't like doing that. At one point, my mother and this manager at one point went so far as to, they're like, all right, we're going to reinvent him as the real chubby kid, but they want chubby kids who are redheads with freckles. And so they like dyed his hair and put fake freckles on his face and redid headshots for him. And we have these, and there was a good 3-4 years of Eric's life where if like my brother Sean and I brought this to the table, it fucked him up. He was like violently reactive to these headshots. It was not okay that happened to him. And so it's really, I would love to get your take on where that, not only does it become challenging when you decide, you know what, I'm going to shed some weight, you know, because it does lead to you playing a role where you're doing parkour and you're like the lead guy. And so you're like, cool. So it works out in some degree, but prior to that transition, you know, what is that like where you're pegged as that guy and that's where you're going in, and it's where you're succeeding, where you're getting your bread and butter is from that, you know, does that dawn on you? Does that hit you? Is it something to go through, or what is that like?
Fortunately, though I was physically in lesser shape than I am now, I had a really good support system. So it, to me, it was, my value wasn't ever wound, what wasn't wrapped up in my physicality. Mm-hmm. I think that experience just, if anything, it made me take everything even less personally. Because frankly, mm-hmm. we're constantly being exposed to all different new people, names, advertising, information, our short and our long-term memories constantly taxed. People just identify initially based on what people look like. You know, it's not personal if you're like, hey, remember in that group of people, there's that fat guy, or there was that white guy, or there's that black guy, or that black girl. Like initially, people just pick up on surface level detail to be able to recall an instance. And I think when I made that transition from a chubby kid to more of a leading man, I took way less offense of being people being like, oh, it's just the fat guy. Cause I'll catch myself doing it now. It'd be like, at the restaurant, there was the guy who was talking to us next to the heavier guy. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, it literally isn't always personal, and it can feel that way a bit when you're on set and people want to make you be the chubby kid and give you a donut in every scene. Or I did this UPN show called like The Mullets. And I wasn't fat enough, so they wanted to put a fat suit on me. And meanwhile, I had already like started making this transition in my mind, like I'm gonna take better care of myself. Like I straight up refused. I'm like, no, not doing it. Sorry.
And how does that go down? Do they go?
They were upset. Dude,
they're upset.
Upset. I don't blame them. You know, I'd be upset too, because once again, the director's not personally saying like I'm a, you know, not judging me personally as a bad person. He's saying like, hey, it would be funnier if you were actually like really fat, but were really mobile, you know, like Chris Farley. So it was an interesting shift.
Was that your transition, Kevin, from child actor to adult actor? Did that correspond with that physical shift, or did that come later when you got a bit older?
I think so, but I've always played younger. I mean, I still, you know, people still think I'm younger than I am now, but I always played younger. So I think for me, and even the last movie I did, it was before I came out to Maryland, Warner Brothers film with John Voight. I was playing a wrestler in high school. I was 28. So, But I was on a soap opera for 5 years, and I was, you know, had a girlfriend and was a Dynasty character, and it wasn't in high school, but I wasn't in college. So yeah. I don't know, you know, I think the transition The transition was more just in the flexibility of being a leading man versus a character actor. Maybe.
Well, you're also a handsome dude, which lends a hand to that, you know, because there's a lot of people that change their, you know, I mean, the story of former kid actor, you know, who turns like bodybuilder is fairly consistent too, you know, for men and women, you know, whatever version of that is, you know, for somebody is really consistent because shedding that view that's given to you, you know, just based on your appearance happens one way or another. You know, it just does, you know, sometimes you'll see, you know, whether it's Miley Cyrus becoming like a rock star, Madonna, fuck you, I'm going to like, you know, moon you and flick you off at the same time, to shed this sort of Disney girl status, like whatever it is, it happens. There's a rejection in some way of what happens, but you seem to have done that even as it was happening and afterwards and post really well. You seem to have done that because you say like a very strong support system that you had, a strong family that was there supporting you that didn't, I imagine, didn't allow you to slip into a self-deprecating place or a judgmental place about yourself, that kept you up, and that also, you know, you have had an intelligent mind enough to figure that out, to figure out like, oh, I shouldn't take this personal. This is not someone making fun of me. This is someone just by my appearance.
It's the character. You know?
It's the character. And so outside of that though, is there like a natural, like when you look back at that and knowing yourself now, like, you know, is there a part though where you, I don't know, where like that crossed a line and that was too much to handle? Or was there ever a time where you were like, man, that's fucked up, or that it really did affect you or stuck with you? Or is it you really were able to just maintain that and always have?
Yeah, I think I was okay. You know, I think I was really okay. It was, fortunately I was able to separate the character from the person. And it doesn't hurt that I was fortunate to work a lot, you know, like it helps a lot when you're working, you know, and in order to survive as an artist, you have to, and even like, I'm sure as we've all grown up in our approach to audition rooms, I'm sure have evolved throughout the years. You know, I remember even my approach to my auditions, this kind of critical turning point of being like, okay, I've been doing this for 15 years. I feel like I'm like, I feel like I learned acting on set with actors. It wasn't some formal I didn't go to film school for it and backwards engineer. I just was, boom, I was there. As I got older though, in different roles and challenges, it was like, do I reinvest in this serious Brando method actor approach to my craft? Or do I do what feels more authentic to me, which is to have fun and keep it playful and realize that the success is about doing your best for you, leaving the room and never thinking about it again. Like just get in this cycle of doing the best you can and letting, you know,
the results happen.
That ended up being my approach as I got older. I was just like,
I can relate to that in a lot of ways. It's the obsessive mind of the actor trying to take control of the things that you can take control over and trying to troubleshoot a career that's maybe gone off the rails a little bit. This I'm talking about my own experience. And so trying to handle some of those things, like doubling down on a certain acting technique and trying to take on some things that may improve the success rate and some other stuff going on.
But Kevin's also making this point about, you know, like Kevin, you're like a vet by the time you're 15 or 16. It's like, I'd say like, you know, there's no part of this feels at any point like you were like, oh, I'm a trained vet. I'm more experienced than a majority of the people I'm sitting around with on a set at this point. So it also, you know, by the time you're 22, that weirdly, you still have that maturity in order to be able to make that kind of decision. Cause I didn't make that decision. I made the Brando decision. I was like, oh, I've been acting my whole life, but I have no idea what the fuck I'm doing. So now I'm going to double down and do this other super intensive.
Yeah.
Suddenly I'm going to study things and chop away at everything I ever did, you know, and really mess myself up, quite honestly, and just like try to reinvent the wheel in some poor way instead of what I eventually came to, which was the decision you made, which is like, oh, I need to have fun. I need to be able to enjoy this. I need for this to be a process where I just trust myself and show up and let go of the results and not try to grapple with anything. I think there was a bigger point you were going to make, AJ. Sorry.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you something else, Kevin, which is just looking at your resume, you've worked consistently from the very beginning. And it seems to me, now I know you live in Maryland, that you made some type of conscious decision, it seems like, to audition less or to make acting less of your focus. What was the inspiration for wherever you're at now? What was the inspiration point to do that? It does not sound to me, and perhaps I'm wrong, but I want to hear your story. It does not sound to me that Hollywood said no to you. It seems like you decided to make some life-changing decisions.
I think it's a good observation. The business has changed so much, man, in so many ways. One of your questions you had on here is, what did you spend your Coogan account on? When I turned 18, I think I had 90,000 in my Coogan account, and I invested 30,000 into a dance instructional video that I wrote and produced and directed with Allison Stoner. I took 30, she took 30, and my mom and my dad and her mom put in 30, raised $100,000 to make our DVD. I literally have it here. Look at this. Allison Stoner project, right?
Wow.
And we authored the DVD. We made it. It was like literally a dance instructional video for kids. I sold it to Stars Anchor Bay at the time, went through the whole distribution process. I learned how content is monetized. And it's the first time I hired my own location cinematographer. I was using a Red One camera before there was a firmware to cut it in Final Cut. I learned in editing systems then. Like, I paid for film school at 18 by producing my own project. And it was, I had a buddy who was in New York Film Academy who grew up as an actor at the same time, and they were having him cut 16 millimeter film and glue it together and run it through a projector. And I'm like, this ain't the business, you know? So I was like, whoa, the business is changing. My skill sets have to change. So that's how I not only transitioned from actor and started writing and producing and doing a lot of different stuff over the years, but the first flag for me was 08 when the market crashed globally. I wrote Cheaper by the Dozen 3, a draft for it, and I wanted to get it made because my logic brain of production and distribution of money is like, oh, they're going to recreate franchise films time and time again. They're not going to take risk on new IP. It made a ton of money. They should do a third one. Let's finish it. I tried to get it made and it was no, no, no from Fox. This is Fox. Cut to our video goes viral last year. Disney Plus buys the catalog of 20th Century. They're remaking the film, all diverse cast, adopts a child, none of the original characters. And after, you know, 250 million views of marketing, thought that was pretty disingenuous to not reach out to any of us and be like, hey, you know, there was something magical here. Let's see if we can capture it again. So 08, market changed. I wasn't impressed at the risk that they were taking on content. Content was being created by YouTubers, by influencers. The value of media started going down because it was being consumed so much and so much more became available. 2016, huge turning point for me in the industry. Election year, I watched Hollywood basically say, if you don't think or act like us, you're a bigot or close-minded or dangerous or every other demoralizing title you could give to a human being who thinks differently than you. I grew up in Kansas. Like, I have like hard, strong conservative background, but I grew up in a super liberal industry. I'm literally a balance of both. And I watched so many coastal opinions degrade the rest of the United States. And what happened? People stopped going to movie theaters. They cut their cable box, right? And then, so 2016, I was like, ooh, the market's shifting, the business is shifting. I don't know if this will be an evergreen industry like I thought growing up. I've always had an interest in business. I've done a lot of different businesses in my life. I've always been interested in community building and government. So 2018, I started putting my resume out in DC, in the DC area, to start working with different policy groups from a digital marketing, communications, broadcasting standpoint, because I've done enough content creation, I could swing it. One of my meetings was with the county government in Maryland to build out a government access TV station. So it's you know, commissioner meetings and planning commission, school board and PSAs and educational content. Like, this is your government and this is what it does. I had an opportunity to take a leap of faith, and I did it in 2019. And I got out here and I've built a broadcast division. I've got four producers. I'm finishing building a studio. We got a soundstage approved, 5,000 square feet. We're going to be a regional draw for both community and private industry. Just being able to work with leadership and government and have them start considering tax dollars as infrastructure for business development within a community, and then seeing that come to fruition with the broadcast station, the future soundstage, it's like, whoa, there's growth happening here in content creation, in storytelling, and it's not in Hollywood. And then Corona hit, right? Yeah. And then Corona hit. And what did Corona really do from my standpoint is it really hurt movie theaters more than anything, right? Movie theaters were, I don't mean to say that more than anything, specifically in the industry. Movie theaters are first dollar gross return on an investment, right? If you make a feature film, you're looking for that $13 to $20 movie ticket because that's what the studio gets and that's your first ROI. And then you go through your various sales cycles from streaming down to physical media, et cetera, TV buyouts, the whole lifeline of a piece of content. When the market, when Corona hit, people were scared to go to movie theaters. Movie theaters probably won't come back to like they were ever before. And when I say probably, I mean, it would be really silly for anybody to think movie theaters aren't going to evolve.
So has this given a boost then to what you were doing? Did that suddenly create more of an avenue for what you've been setting up?
Not so government side. Yeah. But just in the business, and this is what I think is so fascinating about entertainment now. If you know that the movie theater is not going to go back to what it was, and the movie theater hasn't evolved since an outdoor theater came indoors, what is the next movie theater? What is the next community? What is the next physically collective experience to take in audiovisual content?
And tell us.
I can't tell you. I've been working on it.
I know. I was like, you got the answer. And you're like, I got it, guys. It's a billion-dollar idea, and I got it. I'm going to hoard it until I see it to fruition.
No, we're going to bring it to reality for sure.
That's awesome. I will say it is very wild that polarizing politics seemed to play a part in you separating from this long-standing career you had built. That's wild.
Half the audience said.
Well, also, but you personally, which is you go, yeah. You know, I'm from Wichita because I have a friend of mine who's a filmmaker and his family's from Ohio. He's a very conservative guy. Mm-hmm. And it's given him a lot of trouble being a part of Hollywood as he endeavors to do something that he feels is outside of politics, you know? Mm-hmm. And I watch him, you know, really struggle with this thing. And so it's interesting to have, you know, to have someone who'd been a part of this very successfully as their whole childhood. And then that become one of, you know, the reasons, not the main reason, to move in a different direction. So that's wild important to point out. Also, though, here's the thing. I'm so glad you're not just an actor. Like, as you were talking about halfway through, I was like, fuck, I'm such an actor, bro. I was like, you like got like after your like 19th sentence that was real long and smart. And I was like, oh, such a fucking actor, bro. Just give me some sides. I'll memorize this monologue. But the truth is it is so nice. It what I'm trying to highlight there, if anyway, is like your brain has obviously always been super capable, and your ability to kind of, you know, your brain's too good to just be memorizing some lines and rolling the dice to see if you get on another set. So
that's
it's
very
so nice.
Sweet, Chris.
No, but it's true. But it really is. No. But it makes absolute sense as to why your life has continued to unfold the way it does. And I'm so glad you've done that and haven't hindered yourself by means of trapping yourself as a former kid actor and like sticking to a plan that maybe existed at 12, you know, because that is the trap. That is the big trap for former kid actors. So it's so nice that like your life has not revolved around. You're not a guy sitting in Hollywood still. That's like, I wrote a Cheaper by the Dozen 3 script and nobody's doing it. So fuck you guys. And just like doing nothing else with your life. You know, mm-hmm. your life is unfolded in such a nice big way. And it's so nice to see. And And I just think about, I thought about it as you were speaking too. I thought there's one question I didn't really get to touch on, which is you see, you know, I relate to you so much in the way you got into the business, the way you ingrained yourself in the business. Like I, you know, my parents and I were choosy, but not like we, if it felt cool, we did it, you know, and it was all kinds of stuff. We did the weird print jobs for local malls and we went out to New York and did all kinds of weird regional theater. And, you know, I did videos for hospitals and, you know, to walk kids through surgery. Like we did all kinds of shit. So for you doing all that, what are the things you did that no one has any idea about, would never remember you from, or that was just so weird? Like something when you think back, you're like, did I do that? Was there just some weird gig or audition process even? Like just, did you end up on like a mall in Mexico City at some point singing a song? You know, it's like, was there something so weird that you, that your life as a kid actor took you to?
Not so crazy weird. I did have a print. You remember Studio City Yogurt on Laurel Canyon and Ventura?
Yeah.
To be the software. But I had literally had an image that I took in New York that was on the side of their ice cream machine up until they got rid of that. So I would go in years later and see I was like 5 years old, see a print job I did on the side of the soft serve, you know, yogurt shop in
that's awesome.
In the Valley.
That's hilarious. That is really
so, Kevin. Yeah. So, yeah, go ahead, AJ.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to ask, we usually end with two questions, one of which you answered, and it's one of my favorite answers given to what you spent your Coogan account money on.
Yeah.
I love that. That's so
I
cool.
want to see this Allison Stoner video. I think it's so funny.
What a
and
genius
amazing
idea.
You did that.
Too.
Yeah, a great thing. That's what I mean. Yeah. I was like, you're destined to not just be an actor. Like you took your Coogan account money and you put up, you made a $100,000 thing that you directed, wrote, and produced, and with somebody else just really talented. Like that's fucking crazy, man. Like we, you know, here we're like the best answers we get is I was like, I went to a lot of clubs, bro. It's like, well, there he goes.
What's our other question?
Our last question is would you let your kids do it?
Wow. I think we'd, I don't know. I don't know. We'll have to see how the market shifts and changes. There's so many other things I've been like thinking about as we've been talking, like other motivating factors of why I said yes to Marilyn and such. I know you keep it to 45, so I think you gotta button it the way you want to button it.
Well, I have the question. I think really, especially for you in particular, as I really grasped, you know, what your professional life was like and personal life, you know, from what you told us is, you know, would you ever be willing to put yourself in a position like your parents put themselves in? Would you ever be willing to commit some move or some like take the endeavor into that real professional place with your children if they really wanted to do it?
Maybe. I mean, I think it's not a yes or a no, just because my brothers and I were the momentum and why we wanted to do it. My parents were never leading us towards anything. And, you know, my older brother was the first to get out at 18 because he was like, I don't think this is a lifestyle I feel very comfortable with moving forward. He went to college, got law degrees, and works for a defense contractor in DC. My little brother, you know, was having a lot of fun and booked Big Time Rush, and it changed his whole life and toured the world and multiple albums. And now they're getting back together and making new music and going on tour. So it's been a wonderful journey despite the challenges and some really odd things that can pop up along the way. You know, we didn't really touch on it, but another motivating factor why I said peace out was like when the Weinstein stuff hit and when the Jeffrey Epstein stuff came out, one of my old representatives were like, you know, number five or six taken down in the Me Too stuff. And I remember going on a hike in Runyon Canyon when he was past that phase and whatever the hell happened behind the scenes, and he pretty much lost his career and he was just seeking moral support. And I remember going on a hike in Runyon and being like, you know, like, cause I've been writing led me to research. I research everything. Right. I was like, you know, that Epstein guy, he's a bad dude. And, you know, like they have like tunnels underneath there and they're into some really odd stuff. And this girl, Ghislaine Maxwell, you know, she's a sub pilot too, like submarines. And, you know, they do some weird stuff there. And he's like, oh, do you really believe that? You really believe that? I'm like, yeah, I do, because I've also seen the underbelly at DC and it's pretty gross too. Cut to when the flight logs come out, he's on them. So not
your
only,
rep, your ex rep,
yeah, my old rep. Was
so you're old. It was an, I think I might know who this is. Maybe there's more than one. And I don't know. I only know this now third hand. I forgot his name. So I don't know if you care to say.
I wouldn't blast him. I wouldn't blast him anyway, but it was
if I'm wrong, it was an agent that represented child actors, predominantly male child actors, young male child actors. And he was, as far as I knew, fired fired. And it was known for a long time that he had inappropriate relationships with young male actors that he represented and friends of theirs and stuff like that. And I knew two stories. I knew one story I heard through the grapevine of someone who had experienced the disgusting tragic side of that. And I had somebody else that was like, no, they were my rep. I never had any of that experience at all. Mm-hmm. Although I did hear stuff, you know, although it wasn't like, you know, I wasn't blindsided.
I was fortunate, but I thought it was crazy later on when I learned, like, wow, I was getting gaslit in real time, being like, you don't believe anything weird happens there. And cut to you on the flight logs, like, whoa, dude. And
so that's and Wayne, correct me when when you were telling your story. So he gets fired and then he reaches out to you and you guys end up on a hike together?
Or yeah, this is after I'd moved out to Maryland, right? So I'd come back in town and it was like, hey, I'm just like, I'm a changed person. And you know, I'm making different choices. And if you're comfortable, like I'd really like to just pick your brain on what's going on in the world. And you know, I've kind of always been a communicator in my community. So I'm always open, but at the time I didn't realize the extent of all of this messiness. And,
holy shit,
you know,
has he ever hit you up since or no? That was just that. And how does that feel? I mean, how do your parents feel? Like, how does that feel that you guys had that close of did that person must have repped you for a long time if you guys kept in contact?
A couple years. Yeah, for sure. I think my whole family we're very fortunate to have avoided the real underbelly of the industry. And you know, this is one guy, everyone knows Harvey Weinstein, but there's even stuff with, like, you know, Keith Raniere and the NXIVM sex cult stuff that came out. Like, Allison Mack from Smallville was a recruiter, you know, and branding women and creating this really, it's odd. DC politics in Hollywood, they're very interconnected.
And sex cults.
They're wildly interconnected. And you have to be careful, man. You really do.
Well, I'm really glad you came out so unscathed, and not just unscathed, like blossomed into a real force, man. It's I think it's really awesome what you're doing, and I just, it makes me inside sort of chuckle at, like, you break the mold of former kid actor, Kevin. Like, you just break it, you shatter it to pieces, because, you know, the former kid actor, as it's presented as someone who's a mugshot or who is really struggling, you know, or who's the punchline, you know, to a joke that just exists. And so for you to have, you know, lived this sophisticated life and to have put together so much since your time, for your older brother to be a defense contract lawyer, for your other brother to have toured the world with music, it's like, you know, you guys, your strong foundation with parents and your strong set of who you guys are, I think shows that there's a version of being a kid actor that is not tragic, that is really wonderful and can be a blessing and can really set a strong foundation for people as they grow in their lives. And that there's no set in stone way of how that goes. I mean, I could have never predicted that's the case, being in rooms with you guys my whole childhood, you know, and auditioning. It's like, that was not, I would have never guessed. I don't think any of you guys would have guessed it. I don't think any agent or director you worked with would have guessed it. So it's really spectacular. I don't know if you ever dwell on it or ever reflect on it, but from the outside in, it's, you know, looking at it, it's really amazing. And I'm so happy you shared part of that with us today. So I'm really grateful.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Is there anything to, and is there any facet of your musings on former kid actors that you feel like we didn't get to? Is there something that, you know, when you think about your time with your brothers, you know, being kid actors, is there some facet of that touches you or that opened up during this conversation that you want to share about?
I think maybe for like a kind of closing thought for me and for all of us, like we have such an incredible community of talented people. And that talent, and we talked a little bit before, that talent transcends the entertainment industry. Like being able to take direction, pick up on detail, think ahead, constantly move forward. Like those are all communication, emotional intelligence. Those are skill sets that are applicable to so many different industries in the world. And any artist needs to, I think when artists are brought up and even in the business in ways too, we're always encouraged to like silo our thought processes. You're the artist, be the artist. That shit. No. Be whatever is authentic to you and evolve with your environment. Like if LA is feeling stagnant and you're passionate for being a performer, like Georgia's been popping off, Louisiana after Katrina blossomed, the Carolinas have opportunity, like Austin's going to have a huge film scene now. Like don't be afraid to be a bigger fish in a smaller pond and see what happens from there. So I have so many artist friends that I wanted to encourage them to keep evolving with the times and recognize the signs and know that your talent is applicable to so many people. We'd be so lucky to have some of the talented people in our community, you know, in their community. And that's what happened when I came here. It was just like open arms, and we would love to hear your thoughts on everything from, you know, setting up an AV room in a courthouse to an approach to an outreach plan. Like there's so many ways that our skill sets as artists can be applied in the real world. And it's encouraging when you look at it that way.
Especially with a super sharp mind like the one you have. So that's awesome, man. Kevin, you're fucking dope, man. You're a great dude. Your family's awesome. I'm so grateful you came on here. I'm so grateful you shared so much of it. Thank you, man. Thank you for being part of the Coogan Chronicles podcast. Wisely spent Coogan account money, right, AJ?
Very wise. The first
very wise.
Know that it actually made an investment. Well done.
Yeah, you're the sage, just so you know, right now. If we did a little pie, if we did a little like a little picture, we had everybody's headshots, you'd be at the top, like a wizard. You'd
have, if we had to rank them, best use of Coogan account funds versus.
Yes, you're at the top of the charts right there. Yeah. So I don't know if you know, but that's definitely you.
Well done.
So thank you again, man. Thank you so much, Kevin.